The Tom Woods Show, episode 853.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I have just returned from a weekend away with my five children. Just me. Their mom is out of town for the weekend, so I thought, what the heck, we'll go on a little vacation together. And I have a feeling there could be parents out there who have five or fewer children who think taking them all by myself somewhere is just the last thing in the world I'd ever want to do. And all I can say to my five girls is thank you for the fact that I've never felt that way, that this was not like some prison I was in. We made wonderful memories and had a wonderful time out of town over the weekend. If you are on Facebook with me, you may have seen me check in and you may know the details of where I was. Doesn't matter. Point is, we had a lot of fun. And now I'm back. And you could say, what the heck? It's a long weekend. I'll take the day off from the show. But you know what? It's President's Day, for heaven's sake. How does the Tom Woods Show not release an episode on President's Day? Right? That can't happen. Ain't no way that's going to happen. So here I am producing what I think might be a moderately length episode, like shortish episode. We'll see. Let me first remind everybody that I offer a free course on the presidents. How about that? It's Brian McClanahan's course. You know Brian. He's been a guest on the show, host of his own podcast, I might add. And Brian has a course for libertyclassroom.com on the presidents. Well, we give this course away as a freebie. And it's a full-fledged course. You can listen to it while you're driving. We've got a full bibliography there of reliable books on the presidents. We've got videos, if you prefer videos. We got MP3s, if you'd like that. It's 22 lessons, and it costs you nothing. How do you get this miracle of 2017? Answer over at freehistorycourse.com. So, this being President's Day, I wanted to remind you, I've got this free course on the presidents, and it's at freehistorycourse.com. What I thought I would do today is say a few things about what I'm seeing in the results of a presidential historian survey conducted by C-SPAN, and somebody emailed this to me and said, you might find the results of this survey interesting. It's C-SPAN Presidential Historian Survey 2017. I will link to it at tomwoods.com/853 in case anybody's interested in looking at it. And what they've done is they've compiled the results of surveys of a bunch of presidential historians into this list. And you can see where a president was, let's say, in the year 2000, in the year 2009, and then the ranking for the year 2017. And you can see if there's been any change. Now, for most of these presidents, they're hasn't been much of a change. Woodrow Wilson has gone down 5 slots in the past 17 years, which is one of the more significant changes, from number 6 down to number 11 in 2017. I suspect the reason for that is that in recent months and over the past year, at Princeton, there's been more attention paid to Wilson's racial views and his views on segregation. I think those have been coming to the fore, and I think that may be helping to influence historians in this direction. Otherwise, I don't really know how to account for this. On the other hand, Grover Cleveland has tumbled 6 places in the past 17 years, and I don't think anybody's been talking about Grover Cleveland at all, except, you know, you and me, maybe. So I don't know what the heck's happening there. But I thought I'd look at some of the top people in this list and just see what we might say about them. Now, I bet you can all tell me who the top person on the list is, right? We all know who this is. Let's say it together. It's Abraham Lincoln. You all know that, right? We all know that. And there's a lot you can say about Lincoln. The thing that I'm the most pleased with that I've written about Lincoln is in my book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. You can get that on Amazon. You can get it at tomwoods.com/books, which also links you to Amazon. But if you want a signed copy from me of any of my books, you can get it at tomwoods.com/books. Anyway, I like the essay I wrote in there. I won't rehash that here, but I'll just say I don't think either the North or the South fully got the significance, ultimately, of Lincoln. It goes way beyond, not that it has nothing to do with slavery, which I think is a silly thing to say, but it goes way beyond that. He's much more significant than that. What's going on there, and even the Southern cause itself, I think the Southerners did not fully appreciate the significance of what they were doing. And this may seem like a bizarre thing to say, but check out that essay in 33 Questions. If you don't have 33 Questions, by the way, that's a good one to start with if you don't have any of my books. And I'm never going to earn another dollar of royalties on that book, so I'm not just shilling for money. Not that there's anything wrong with that, by the way. It's perfectly fine to ask for money, but I'm just letting you know, given the advance I got, I ain't never seen another dollar on that book. I just think it's a helpful book. If I'd had that book when I was 18 years old, the years of study I would have been able to avoid. I don't even want to think about it. So much I would have known already, and I wouldn't have had to dig out for myself. So I have cut down on your learning curve a lot with that book in particular. 33 Questions would be the one I would recommend. And then the second one, if you like that one, if you don't like that one, go jump in a lake. But if you like that one, then check out my book, Real Descent. That was so much fun to put together. Oh, man, because I get to go after all different people. Not so much leftists in that one. You'd think that would be people I'd go after because I've been doing that so much lately, but it's mostly neocons. If you miss that, Tom Woods, against the neocons, you'll love Real Descent. And then I have a little section where I go after some of the irritating libertarians. I mean, there's just something for everybody in Real Descent. So that's over at realdescent.com. And you can even get the audiobook version. That's the only book I've done where I'm narrating the audiobook. So if you'd like to hear me reading one of the books, that's the one. So anyway, realdescent.com also has a link to how you can get that audiobook for free. All right, let me get back to the thing for the thing here, which is Abraham Lincoln. What I want to do is I'm going to run through something I did way, way back in one of the very first episodes of this show. I was talking about Lincoln, and I ran you through a quiz that was put together by Clyde Wilson, one of the great living Southern historians. Clyde Wilson is also the editor of the papers of John C. Calhoun. He's been a professor at the University of South Carolina. Even his enemies admit he is one of the great historians. And it's hard to get your enemies to admit anything about you, especially in this day and age. We saw you in front of a flag. That's all we need to know about you. It's unbelievable what's happened to people. I retweeted a picture of Jimmy Carter standing in front of the Confederate battle flag. Now, this is Jimmy Carter. So we have libertarians now who are to the left of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter said this flag is okay. You're like, enough's enough here. Quit with the virtue signaling. The flag is okay. A lot of people died for that cause. Oh, the cause was only about slavery. Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? An army is marching into your town. They're going to set fire to everything. Everybody's going to be homeless, including children. And it got to a point, I've mentioned this before, where Jefferson Davis was reduced to telling people that in an emergency, they could actually eat rats, that rats were in fact edible. That's how bad it got. What were people supposed to do? Forget about slavery for a minute. What were you going to do in that situation? Say, well, Mr. Righteous Northern Soldier, sir, I realize we have displeased you because of our policies that we have no influence over whatsoever. And so because our government is responsible for policies you don't like, I deserve to be starved to death and have my home burned to the ground and my town destroyed. And the same thing happened to my family. Is that really what you're going to say? Anyway, so I say if you want to fly that to recognize that you're related to somebody who died protecting his home, I don't have any problem with that. I think that's a very normal reason to fly a flag. And you're talking to a guy who lived most of his life. I lived almost all of it in the North. I lived in Massachusetts till I was 21. Then I lived in New York until, when did I move away from there? Was I 34? Yeah, I was 34. I'm only 44 now. Right. Yeah, I'm 44 now. So most of my life was lived in the North. I just think fair's fair, right? Leave these people alone. Which basically was Lincoln's view. He had a very conciliatory view toward the South. It was not at all his desire to say, well, from now on, we're not ever going to let them sing Dixie again or something. No, to the contrary, he loved Dixie. He was a normal person. He was not trying to deface every single Southern symbol. I don't know how I got off on this. Anyway, here's the quiz, and you will note something about the answers to this quiz. All right, this is a quiz, presidential quiz from Clyde Wilson. Here we go. What American president launched a massive invasion of another country that posed no threat and without a declaration of war? What president raised a huge army at his own will without the approval of Congress? What president started a war of choice in violation of every principle of Christian just war teaching? What president said that he had to violate the Constitution in order to save it? What president declared the elected legislatures of 13 states to be, quote, combinations, unquote, of criminals that he had to suppress? What president said he was indifferent to slavery but would use any force necessary to collect taxes? What president sent combat troops from the battlefield to bombard and occupy New York City? What president sent the army to arrest in the middle of the night thousands of private citizens for expressing their opinions and held them incommunicado in military prisons with total denial of due process of law, and had his soldiers destroy newspaper plants? What president was the first ruler in the civilized world to make medicine a contraband of war? What president signed for his cronies special licenses to purchase valuable cotton from an enemy country, even though he had forbidden such trade and punished other people for the same practice? What president refused medical care and food to his own soldiers held by the enemy country? What president presided over the bombardment and house-by-house destruction of cities and towns that were undefended and not military targets? What president's forces deliberately targeted women and children and destroyed their housing, food supply, and private belongings? What president's occupying forces engaged in imprisonment, torture, and execution of civilians and seizing them as hostages? Under what president did the army have the largest number of criminals, mercenaries, and foreigners? Who was the first American president to plot the assassination of an opposing head of state? Who had the least affiliation with Christianity of any American president and blamed God for starting the war over which he presided? What president voted for and praised a law which forbade black people from settling in his state? What president said that all black people should be expelled from the United States because they could never be full-fledged citizens? What president was the first to force citizens to accept as legal money pieces of paper unbacked by gold or silver? Who was the first president to institute an income tax? Who was the first president to pile up a national debt too vast to be paid off in a generation? Who is considered almost universally as the greatest American president, indeed as the greatest American of all times, and as a world hero of democracy? And then finally, what predecessor is President Obama most often compared to? All right, I'm going to take all the fun. I'm going to suck all the fun out of that quiz by telling you, in case we have non-American listeners who are not going to be familiar with this, the answers are all the same. It's all Abraham Lincoln. And it's just interesting to ask all those questions because those aren't things that kids in schools learn about Lincoln ever. Not ever. And that should creep us out. Because if anybody in any other country had waged a war of national unification that had had results of that kind, and then was being used to make sure everybody has the right opinions on whether nationalism and centralization are a good thing, I mean, we would think that was weird and creepy and the sort of thing that happens in banana republics or in particularly creepy dictatorships. So this is a problem. So that's my comment on Abraham Lincoln. I'm going to go over, skip George Washington for now. I'll probably have to do an episode on him at some point. I have a bit of a soft spot for George Washington, even though during his presidency there were things that, you know, he let Hamilton run amok and things that are hard to forgive. But the fact that he laid down his command at the end of the War for Independence is truly an amazing thing in world history. And it stunned the rest of the world. And there's a part of me that thinks, well, he deserves something for that. But let's move on to Franklin Roosevelt, number three. He's number three on the list. So you can do the camps for the Japanese Americans, and that'll not really affect your ranking any, apparently, according to these historians. That won't affect your ranking. You can try and cover up a break-in into the Democratic National Committee, which didn't actually result in anybody being confined anywhere, except a few of the burglars wound up going to jail, and that puts you way down at like number 30. But Franklin Roosevelt, how about that? Well, what I find really interesting about this is that Herbert Hoover, his immediate predecessor, you know where he is in this list? Number 36. Hoover is number 36 in this list. Now, the reason that's significant to me is that Hoover pretty much was the originator of so much of the New Deal. As the brain truster of Franklin Roosevelt's administration, Rexford Tugwell, later openly admitted that most of the New Deal is just an extrapolation from what Hoover was already doing. So what are they cheering Franklin Roosevelt on for? For implementing these programs? For curing the Depression? He certainly didn't cure the Depression. And don't come at me, tell me World War II cured the Depression, because that, you got me really depressed about that, if you're saying that. Let me make sure I still have my resource page that smashes that. You can't go that way. You can't argue that. Because not only is it wrong, but if you do argue that, then you lose every economic argument from now until the end of time, because your friends will say, well, even you say that if there's enough spending, an economy will revive. So you've got to realize something wrong with that argument. And I've talked about it already, probably on the show, but also at libertyclassroom.com/war. I have a free resource page on this exact topic, so you can visit it there. I'll try and remember. Let me get my notes out here. Heaven's sake, I'm all disorganized being out of town. You hear that? That's the old notebook, my friend. All right, what the heck episode? 853, we're going to do the war and depression page. We're going to do the presidential quiz. I'll link to that. All right. Was there something else? If there's something else I said I would link to, I've already forgotten what it is. All right, anyway, so there's Hoover doing pretty much the same thing. Because what does Hoover do? He's got his own early version. Again, in each case, it won't be quite as developed as Franklin Roosevelt's will be, but it's the same idea. He pioneers it. He's obviously trying to go in the right direction. They're actually putting him at number 36 because he came up with all the right ideas. He just didn't push them far enough. Really? Who could be that petty? Now, he must be down there because they're still trying to claim he's somehow responsible, or, you know, he was a laissez-faire guy who didn't do anything. What kind of a blockhead would you have to be to still believe that now? After PBS, you can Google Herbert Hoover, depression, maybe the word intervention. Even PBS says, look, we got Hoover all wrong. He really was a progressive or a proto-progressive. He really was a technocrat who wanted his hands in everything and he wanted to manage everything. The last thing in the world the guy wanted was a hands-off free market. And he said so over and over again, all through the 20s, as Commerce Secretary. He said this over and over and over again, that the age of laissez-faire is dead. You know, what we need now is public-private partnerships and all the rest of that crap. All right, so what do we get? We got agriculture under Hoover that is a forerunner of what FDR will do. We have an attempt to push wage rates up, thinking that at a time when prices are collapsing and businesses are failing, we need to give everybody an implicit raise. That originated under Hoover and was perfected, if you want to call it that, under Franklin Roosevelt. We've got all kinds of public work spending and deficit spending on a very significant scale, comparable to under George W. Bush in terms of percentage of GDP. So we're not talking about nothing. We're talking about more spending on public works in 4 years than it had been spent in the previous 20. And of course, that's something, again, that Franklin Roosevelt will pick up on. And there's just program after program after program under Herbert Hoover, and yet he's down at number 36. It's unbelievable. And Franklin Roosevelt is up, you know, because it starts to turn right around the time that he takes power. It starts to turn. It always starts to turn. No matter what, whether president do something or don't do something, it always starts to turn. At some point, it's going to turn. The question is, why did it go on so darn long? That's the question. During all of Roosevelt's interventions, where he's basically going to impose a 30s-style, fascistic-style economic management via production codes on every industry, And I talk about this, and you know, again, you can get the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. We'll give one of my books will give you more details about this. But he winds up with double-digit unemployment all through the 30s. And by 1939, his Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, said, look, we've been doing this. We've been spending and spending and spending like crazy the whole decade, and it just doesn't work. We still have extremely high unemployment. And yet he's number three. Now, there are historians, even somebody like Doris Kearns Goodwin, who will openly say, all right, we have to admit the New Deal obviously did not lift us out of the Depression, clearly. I mean, they're honest enough to admit that. But what they, honest to goodness, I promise you I'm not making this up, what they fall back on is, but he gave us hope. He gave us hope. That's what gets you up to number three on the list. He gave us hope. Good heavens. What hope is there for the rest of us? All right, let's look at who else is up there. Theodore Roosevelt. All right, there's a fun one. But haven't I talked a lot about Theodore Roosevelt? We did an episode on Theodore Roosevelt. I think I'll link to that. Episode on Theodore Roosevelt. The first Mises Institute talk I ever gave was on Theodore Roosevelt, actually. It was at their presidency conference, and I get up. I was still a graduate student, and I gave a talk on Theodore Roosevelt. You can find that at Mises.org if you're interested. But Theodore Roosevelt, I mean, look, everybody's all upset about executive orders. The people immediately prior to Theodore Roosevelt were issuing like 70 a year, 50 a year, 10 a year, 6, 0. Theodore Roosevelt, 1,006. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there's anything bad going on, but it does kind of mean a little bit there's some kind of a change happening. His view really was the president can do whatever he's not expressly forbidden from doing in the Constitution. You know, I like to give the example because it's such an obscure one, people will miss it. But the case of the Dominican Republic, there was a treaty that he wanted the Senate to pass with the Dominican Republic, and they dismissed for recess without acting on it, and he wanted it passed, so he just renamed it an executive agreement and declared it to be in force. So that's the kind, I mean, that was his entire style, and he boasted about this. And again, there's more you can say about him. You could either listen to that talk, or the Mises Institute has a free book online called Reassessing the Presidency. It has my chapter on Theodore Roosevelt in there, so you might want to look at that. Number five, Dwight Eisenhower. That's an interesting choice. Eisenhower was sort of the typical Me Too Republican. He's not going to undertake any massive new initiatives, but he's going to consolidate the existing ones. So whether it's increasing the minimum wage or expanding Social Security availability or whatever, that sort of thing. In foreign policy, I mean, he was, you know, reasonably decent on the budget. In foreign policy, people will say, well, he's good because he really did keep the military budget under control. And that is true. On the other hand, it's really under Eisenhower that the intelligence agencies start getting out of control, where they start being used as instruments of foreign policy. Instead of just being these intelligence gathering agencies, they really become entrenched as actual actors in the making of foreign policy. And you see that, for example, in the undercover work in Iran and in Guatemala. Those are the most well-known examples under Eisenhower. But then also one way he was able to cut down on the military spending was to place greater emphasis in the U.S.'s military strategy on nuclear weapons. And therefore we can get more bang for our buck was the literal expression that was used. We'll just threaten to blow everybody to smithereens and, you know, forget having to worry about anything else and more conventional methods when we have these nuclear weapons. So there's that to bear in mind. Harry Truman, oh my goodness gracious. I got to link you to the Ralph Rako essay on Truman, because even if you don't wind up getting that book by the Mises Institute, I at least want you to see the Rako essay on Truman. One of my favorite essays on any subject ever is the Rako essay on Harry Truman. I have a chapter in the book I did with Kevin Gutzman called Who Killed the Constitution. We have a chapter on the seizure of the steel mills by Harry Truman. He came up with all kinds of pained justifications for why, during the Korean War, he could seize the steel mills and send in the army and then just run the steel mills because they couldn't settle a dispute in the steel industry. And so, look, I need steel, so we're just going to go in there and grab it. And the Supreme Court at that time actually, believe it or not, told him you're not allowed to do that. How about that? You can't just go in and take over private property. And the arguments made in against Truman weren't the strongest in the world, but at least they were no's. At least they were against, which is something. But Truman was very much in the Theodore Roosevelt leadership style, let's say. I like the RACO story about immediately after World War II, they kept a lot of the price controls in force, for example, on meat. And so what do you think happened? There were shortages of meat. And Truman doesn't immediately draw the conclusion, well, why don't we just get rid of the price controls? Obviously. Hello, right? No, the reason was that those farmers are hoarding that meat. And we got to go and seize that from them. And so he contemplated sending out the Army and the National Guard to seize livestock from American farms. And then he decided that this was not a practical thing. They were too spread out. It'd be hard to do it. And then they got rid of the price controls on meat, and amazingly, meat came back into abundance once again. Truman could have been worse if he had gotten more of his legislation through. He was not able to get national health care through. He wasn't able to do a lot of things he wanted to do. He wasn't able to build on the New Deal the way he wanted to. So we're lucky for that. And then, of course, there's the atomic bombings, and I really do want to do a whole episode on that. I just haven't been able to find just the right person for that topic. So I do want to revisit that, but you'll see some good material on that in the Ralph RACO essay. Now, Thomas Jefferson is here at number 7, which is very interesting to me. Thomas Jefferson gets there at number 7. Now, this is a guy who urged the nullification of the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. Now, I realize they're ranking him based only on his presidency, which I get. He was elected in 1800. But he goes out of his way to pardon everybody who had been punished under that and to return any fines that had been paid with interest, interestingly. So he carries on with his views on that legislation. So that's something good. We all know there were bad sides to the Jefferson time in office, and a lot of people will point to the Louisiana Purchase and say he did that without constitutional authorization. But actually, Jefferson was really alone among the Republicans in feeling like he didn't have constitutional authorization for that. The standard argument was that, you know, the treaty-making power certainly does cover this. So I haven't been particularly troubled about that as much as, obviously, the enforcement of the embargo that began at the end of 1807, then carried through to the end of Jefferson's tenure, because there you had ships whose cargoes were being seized basically on suspicion of intent to run the embargo and to engage in trade in defiance of the embargo. And, you know, there are supposed to be certain standards you have to abide by before you can confiscate somebody's stuff, and mere suspicion seems to be rather on the low side of that scale. What's sometimes overlooked about Jefferson, I really should have asked Kevin Gutzman about this, is the argument that his choices on the judiciary were not really as strong as they might have been. Because here's his real opportunity to shape American history, is his appointments to the Supreme Court, and especially with a guy with as powerful a personality, as dominant a personality as John Marshall on the court, you really need to balance him out. And Jefferson's 3 Supreme Court appointments did not turn out to be all that impressive. They did not, as Scott Trask and Kerry Roberts point out, none of them consistently upheld the compact theory of the Constitution, which is what Jefferson was all about, which I've talked about on the show a lot. The 3 Supreme Court appointments were William Johnson, Henry Brockholst Livingston, and Thomas Todd. And each one was more disappointing than the previous one. Thomas Todd wound up more or less being a rubber stamp for Marshall, and that was that. But meanwhile, there were people Jefferson could have appointed. He supposedly had wanted to appoint Spencer Rowan, who had been on the Virginia Court of Appeals for a long time, who was very much in line with Jefferson's thinking, was a great legal mind. He had wanted to appoint him as Chief Justice if Marshall hadn't been appointed toward the end of the John Adams term. So how come that never happened? Or why was Rowan never put forward as a name? Then there was St. George Tucker, one of the great Virginia constitutional theorists of the 1790s, who wrote a great volume. Again, I've probably talked about, I can't remember, but St. George Tucker is very, very, very much worth reading. And again, agrees completely with Jefferson on the compact nature of the Union. What happened to that? Why didn't we get that? So that, to me, would bring Jefferson down a bit. You know, so who knows why they're putting Jefferson up? They feel like they've got to. I don't know what. Who knows? American historians, you can't trust them with anything. So if Jefferson got up here, it's almost by accident. John F. Kennedy, I think I'm just going to stop with John F. Kennedy, because John F. Kennedy is in the number eight position. Why? Seriously, on what possible grounds would you put Kennedy as number eight? Now, I would put Kennedy as number eight precisely because he didn't get much done. But these are people who are hyper-interventionists. They can't get enough intervention. Well, what does Kennedy have to point to? He accomplished basically nothing. Well, seriously, think about it. What did he accomplish? And the things he did do were bad. He positively cheered on Fed inflation. That's a bad thing. He engaged in the jawboning of the steel industry, which was a very bad thing. I talk about that in my U.S. history course at libertyclassroom.com. That was not something to cheer. That was a bad thing. And his foreign policy wasn't particularly impressive either. And he wound up pushing the U.S. farther into Vietnam. And then there's some theory that he was going to get us out. But I don't think that's a definite by any means. There's some possibility of it, but I don't think that's a definite. But other than that, what do we remember him for? I hope it's not for giving us hope. You know, heaven help me. For giving us more hope. That's what these people get paid this money for and wind up getting six-figure speaking fees afterward, forever after, because they gave some speeches they didn't even write that gave us hope. You got to be kidding me. That's it? Crazy. All right, look, that's your President's Day, all right? Hope you enjoyed it. That's it. That's all I got to say. If you want that course, check it out at freehistorycourse.com so you get more about the presidents. If you've been enjoying the show, consider joining me in the elite as a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com, and I will see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.